Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Andrew Ross, Executive Foreign and National Editor at the San Francisco Chronicle. It is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Vali Nasser, Professor of Middle East and South Asia Politics at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, Adjunct Senior Fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, author of The Shia Revival, How Conflicts Within Islam Will Shape the Future, and co-author of Democracy in Iran, History and the Quest for Liberty, both published this year. The issues Dr. Nasser writes about and will talk about tonight are more than just academic for our guest. Quoting from a recent front-page article about him in the Wall Street Journal, Dr. Nasser hails from a prominent intellectual and literary family that traces its lineage to the Prophet Muhammad. His father was once president of Iran's top science university and chief of staff for the Shah's wife. Leaving Iran in 1979 after the Iranian Revolution, the Nasser family, quote, started from zero in the United States. From zero, Dr. Nasser went on to get his BA from Tufts, a master's from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, and a doctorate from MIT. His father is now a professor of Islamic studies at George Washington University. Dr. Nasser has written for the New York Times and the Washington Post, and I should note, with many thanks, has been a most valuable source for the Chronicle. He has also appeared on National Public Radio, the BBC, the NewsHour, with Jim Lehrer, and CBS News, though not yet with Katie Couric. Such an honor, I'm sure, can't be far off. Please welcome Vali Nasser.
Good evening. Thank you, Andrew, for that generous introduction, and thank you to the Commonwealth Club for inviting me to this occasion. Everywhere we turn these days, there's talk of Iran. The country's profile in terms of a challenge to a U.S. foreign policy has been rising steadily in the past 2-3 years, and it has sort of reached a crescendo in the sense that Iran's nuclear file now poses a serious challenge to U.S. foreign policy making. It is a test of both U.S. power and its ability to shape the behavior of regimes globally, but in particular in the Middle East, as well as also it's viewed as a, in some quarters at least, as an imminent or a serious threat to regional stability and to U.S. interests in the region. But what is most interesting about Iran is the time frame in which the U.S. is actually encountering the problem of Iran. In other words, Iran is not just, quote-unquote, a rogue state or a problem state in quest for nuclear power. It is emerging essentially as a regional power. It is an overconfident state. It wants to talk with the United States, unlike North Korea. It wants to engage globally in trade and otherwise, but it wants to do on its own terms, without preconditions, and without being looked down to or put in its place, but with acknowledgement of its role and interests in the region. This is not a new problem for the United States. We've dealt many times previously in history with rising powers, sometimes successfully, as the case of China, and sometimes unsuccessfully, as the case of the rise of Japan, for instance, in East Asia. Now, Iran is the problem that Iran poses is the larger problem, that the rise of Iran is essentially redefining the Middle East. By the virtue of a major power emerging that is capable of projecting its interests and powers everywhere. If we looked, we initially thought that, okay, Iran can meddle in Iraq, but that's the extent of it. And then Iran was able to essentially shape the Lebanon war, redefine the Arab-Israeli issue, and essentially cleanly pick the pocket of the Arab regimes with the Palestinian cause and appropriate it. So Iran's capable of asserting its power far beyond its borders. It is keen on acquiring nuclear technology and or a nuclear weapon at some point in the future, both to give it a mark of its having arrived, if you would, and also its ability to protect its position. Now, we looked at Iran for a long time, expecting it to basically keel over, to fall. We were looking throughout the decade of the 90s at what we thought was a tired, lethargic dictatorship, theocracy, that had lost touch with its own population, that it was gradually opening up. And in fact, we were so confident that it was going to be replaced that we thought there is no necessity to talk to the reformist president who was then ruling Iran. We constantly heard talk of the Iranian youth that is tired of this regime, is pro-Western, is pro-American, that it wants better things. But none of that has really panned out. In other words, if anything, what we're seeing in Iran is a retrenchment and a strengthening of the theocracy. And if that's not enough, it actually is becoming, in some quarters, more popular, and it's not content with only power. It actually wants to go back to the moment of enthusiasm of the early years of the revolution. In other words, let's relive it all over again, which is in some ways quite unique, and other communist countries who went through similar phases of ideology and revolution never proved successful of being able to relive that original moment. But Iran seems to be moving in that direction under its current president. When we look at Iran, we still see a theocratic government in which the head of state claims to be have religious mandate for his position, is unaccountable to the constitution in Iran, and is unelected. But Iran is also becoming increasingly a very militaristic political system, that the Revolutionary Guards, who originally were the Praetorian Guards of the Iranian Revolution, have become increasingly more powerful and are occupying positions of power. For instance, a third of Iran's parliament is now controlled by the Revolutionary Guards. The current president is a veteran of the Revolutionary Guards. Large numbers of very powerful foundations, ministries, and various other institutions in Iran are now run by the Revolutionary Guards. In fact, as one of their commanders said, we look to the east, we see militaries in power in Pakistan. We look to the west, we see militaries in power in Turkey. Why not in Iran? And in many ways, what we're seeing is sort of the retrenchment of theocracy in Iran is associated with greater militarization of Iranian politics. But that said, Iran still remains a very interesting society, a very complicated and complex society. Perhaps no other society in the Middle East is, I would say, as democracy-ready as the Iranian society is. It's a country of about 70 million people, which is, outside of Egypt, is probably the largest population in the Middle East, 70% of whom are literate. The Persian today is the third largest language on the internet. There are something like 85,000 Iranian blogs on the internet, about 12% of which deal with political issues. The other 80-some percent deal with all sorts of things. Every Ayatollah of known I know in Iran has his own webpage and his own weblog. If you look at the Iranian presidential campaign, it was, I would say, lockstep with, you know, the American use of the web in terms of propagating the message and raising funds and getting the word out. A number of important news outlets in Iran, conservative as well as moderate reformist, are essentially just webzines. In other words, they don't exist physically. They're completely on the internet. And it is a fairly sophisticated economy. Iran has the largest economy in the Middle East. It's larger than Egypt's economy, and it's twice the size of Saudi Arabia's economy. And if you factor out oil, it is multiple times larger than the Saudi economy. So in some ways, it was expected that Iran essentially will gradually become the Tutan elephant of this region, regardless of who ruled over it, that it was like India is in South Asia. It has the landmass, It has the natural resources. It's the world's second largest gas reserves and one of the world's largest oil reserves. It has the manpower in terms of literacy, sophistication, and it is also very integrated into the global economy and particularly into global culture, which is one of the sort of paradoxes of Iran. You have a closed religious society which can produce cinema that is recognized as global cinema, and you can pick up any Iranian daily and read debates between Habermas and Foucault and you know, all kinds of schools of Western thought. The question that comes up is then, what happened last year? Why did this democracy sort of infrastructure did not translate into a democratic turning point? And particularly because at least the Iranians themselves believe that they do have certain democratic practices. It's true that this is not an open society, and elections are in multiple ways are interfered with by the government, but that the Iranians themselves take the voting seriously. And actually, interestingly, the lower classes and the more pro-regime elements who don't see any problem with the system take the democracy even more seriously than secular or reformist Iranians do. And it's not only at the national level. There are now city councils elected across Iran. There are village councils elected. Even though Iran does not have a democratic system, there is plenty of practice. And as an average Iranian knows what voting is, what campaigning is, and what the give and take of democracy is. And in the elections of 2005 actually proved to be a rather sophisticated electoral campaign, that all sides took it seriously. They, for instance, some of the conservative candidates, by their own admission, followed Tony Blair's campaign with the Labour Party in England. Others adopted, for instance, measures from the U.S. Campaigns of forming focus groups to understand what ideas fly with the population and which ones do not. But the election results, end of the day, were a disappointment. By many accounts, of the 27 million votes that were cast, probably 16 million votes went to reformist candidates, and about 11 million went to the two conservative candidates. But there were too many reformists running, and they divided the vote. And without a doubt, the Ahmadinejad campaign also engaged in some kinds of shenanigans and the like, just enough to get him over the top. But by and large, at least the Iranian population did not see the voting as flagrant enough to protest it. And there were something in the order of 142 American journalists in Iran at the time of the Iranian elections, the largest single media representation in Iran. So things such as how many people actually turned out to vote or not were sort of attested to by the observers. But what is interesting is that whereas the West for a very long time looked at Iran and thought that the only issue there is democracy versus theocracy, it didn't play quite like that in the election. First of all, democracy got sort of mixed up with many other things. Most importantly, democracy had come to be seen, or reform, let me put it this way, reform in Iran had come to be associated with gridlock. The reformist government that was ruling Iran for 10 years had not been able to do anything. It had not been able to change any laws. It had not been able to push further with reforms. But worse than that, it had not really governed very well. It had not really been able to address unemployment, social frustrations, and the like. And they were building up in Iran. In particular, there was a great deal of resentment among the lower classes towards the growing gap between rich and poor in Iran, which, you know, early on, the Iranian Revolution criticized the Shah's regime for fostering policies that created a gap between the rich and the poor. But throughout the 1990s, late 80s and throughout the 1990s, Iran engaged in a very serious program of privatization, which led to corruption, creation of millionaire mullahs, like Iran's one of the presidential candidates and former president Ayatollah Rafsanjani, and also a growing gap between the wealthy north of Tehran and the poorer south of Tehran. And the poor began to sort of look at reformists essentially not from the angle of democracy, but from the angle of economic resentment. And conservative forces, and particularly Ahmadinejad, manipulated this very effectively. Most of his campaigns were showing his very modest house in south of Tehran in the poor neighborhoods, and then comparing it with the mansions of Tehran's former mayor or other senior Iranian elite. He posed as, if you would, as an outsider, the way an American politician does vis-a-vis Washington, and it was very effective. In a sense, the campaign he ran is very similar to that of Chavez in Venezuela or Evo Morales in Bolivia. He was a man of the people, a man of the poor. And also another issue that became very important for Iranians was effective governance. It's a kind of thing we're also seeing in Iraq. That, you know, people like democracy if democracy delivers. If it doesn't, there are other priorities that come before democracy. And the conservative leadership had a simple message that, A, they have the power to govern. The reformists may have the good ideas, may promise you liberty, but they can neither deliver liberty nor can they promise governance. In fact, they would say that the logical choice is to vote conservative. And one of the things they would say is that we can get along with the supreme leader because we come from the same camp. So the gridlock would go away. And secondly, Ahmadinejad in particular had used his time as mayor of Tehran, particularly with the support of Iran's Revolutionary Guards and the supreme leader, to position himself as a clean, effective manager. On the campaign trail, he didn't talk about Israel or all the contentious issues he talks about now. He was very narrowly focused on poverty, jobs, and effective government. And that's actually what won him a lot of support. He didn't get many votes in the wealthier suburbs of North Tehran, but he did fairly well in the small towns and provincial areas. And even to this day, most of his speeches are given in faraway provinces and small towns to large crowds. It was coincidental, perhaps, that this change of government in Iran, you know, shifting from a reformist like President Khatami, who's now visiting Washington, to Ahmadinejad, coincided with other big changes in the region, which is really caused by the war on terror and Iraq, and the very, if you would, momentum of Iran to try to become a regional power. Now, Iran, the elements of why Iran feels it's a regional power does not have to do with Iraq. It had to do with Iran's economy, rise of private sector, the entire sort of manpower capability of Iran, all of those things that was already coming. What Iraq and Afghanistan did was to remove barriers that had been in the region around Iran for it to exert its power. In other words, by the fall of the Taliban and the fall of Saddam removed two Sunni governments who for a number of years now had been containing Iran in alliance with Saudi Arabia and Persian Gulf Emirates. Now, the United States removed these for reasons that did not have to do with Iran. It did it because it saw one as involved in the war on terror and the other one for the argument of weapons of mass destruction. And it went around the argument that Iran's going to be a beneficiary by saying, well, you know, change of regime in Iraq will threaten and ultimately topple the Iranian regime as well. But it didn't work out that way. In other words, the removal of Saddam and Taliban, even though justified or unjustified in their own terms, nevertheless allowed Iran at a moment of growth all of a sudden to also find the room to grow. And Iran basically took advantage of this. And Iran at the beginning was in no way actually opposed to what the U.S. was doing. Iran cooperated very positively with the U.S. in putting together the government in Afghanistan. And Iranians and basically their allies in among the Shiites of Iraq basically turned away their gaze while the U.S. essentially finished off the Saddam regime. And they would have liked to see the U.S. finish off the insurgency as well, which has not come to pass. But in Iraq also, Iran found it an additional issue, and that is that the fall of Saddam transferred power to the Shiites in Iraq. Now, majority of Iraq's population are Shia by faith. It happened that Saddam's regime was a very sectarian regime. It had become, over the years, narrowly based in the Sunni tribes of Saddam's own territory, which happened to be particularly anti-Shia. Saddam viewed the Shia as a threat during the Iran-Iraq war, viewed them as not a member of the Iraqi or Arab nation. He always accused them of being Iranian or of Iranian or being loyal to Iran. And also, after they rose in rebellion in 1991, and the Kurds also rose in rebellion the same year, except the Kurds got to get out of Iraq because of the no-fly zone that was established in northern Iraq. So Iraq effectively, between 1991 and 2003, was just the Arab part of it. And in the Arab part of it, the Shiites are an overwhelming majority of probably about 80%, 80 to 85%. And when they rose in rebellion in 1991, expecting that the United States was going to intervene, and when the U.S. didn't, something like 300,000 Shiites in Iraq were massacred, and another 100,000 at least escaped to Iran. And for the remaining 10, 12 years, this was essentially a Sunni regime suppressing a Shia majority. So once the regime was removed, it was inevitable that the sectarian issue would come to the fore. Now, the fact that nobody, you know, thought about how to handle this meant that nobody was prepared for it. And as a result, it has become increasingly aggravated. Now, Iran had always looked at Iraq as a problem, and this is not to do with the Islamic Republic. Ever since the fall of monarchy in 1958, Iraq had been an enemy of Iran. There had always been problems during the Shah's period, and there was a decade-long war in Iran in which, you know, between the two countries, about 1 million people died in that war. And a lot of Iran's current leadership, including this president, are veterans of that war. So they are very, very keenly aware of the Iraqi threat to Iran, strategic threat to Iran over the years. Now, the Iranian leadership under the Shah or under Khomeini believed that Iraqi hostility to Iran is a Ba'athist Sunni phenomenon, and that there are historical ties that bind Iran and Iraq, and that a Shiite Iraq might not be friendly to Iran, ultimately, but always will be friendlier to Iran than a Sunni Iraq would be. So job number one for the Iranians was that the Ba'athists don't come back to power. And job number two was to make sure that Iraq remains in Shia hands. And then third was to protect specifically Iranian interests in Iraq through funding of various group parties, alliances, and the like. And the fact that Iran was able to now exert its influence in Iraq, in an Arab country, which is previously close to it, was itself an expansion of Iranian power. And then we saw that very recently, that with Iran and Hezbollah being able to effectively make a show of force over the Arab-Israeli issue, that Iran is able to project power far beyond just its immediate neighboring countries, but really can also exert force far, far beyond. But what the case of Hezbollah showed is that what began in Iraq, which is essentially, I term it, the Shia revival, is essentially now an element of Iranian power. Not that the Shias are beholden to Iran or controlled by Iran, but that they share same objectives and face the same enemies. And the Hezbollah's war against Israel was not defined as a Shia-Sunni issue by Hezbollah. Was defined as a Shia-Sunni issue by Arab governments and by radical Sunni clerics who very quickly came out and condemned Hezbollah and called it a Shia organization and tried to influence their own population not to look favorably upon Hezbollah's action in Lebanon. But like it or not, the Lebanon war essentially created an intersection between the oldest conflict in the Middle East, the one that has been ongoing and matters most, which is the Arab-Israeli conflict, and the newest conflict in the Middle East, which is coming out of Iraq, which is the Shia-Sunni conflict. And it also confirmed one thing, that all the cards are essentially held right now by Iran and Hezbollah, essentially, by the alliances that came out of the changes that the region has been seeing. And most of the regimes that the United States has been allied with proved that they essentially were irrelevant to the conflict. They neither could stop the conflict, nor they could force the United States to bring about a ceasefire. They didn't essentially have any major role to play, which for the United States means that the main challenge for it is that after a very long time, it's dealing with a Middle East in which it doesn't have any allies can help it to manage things. Because for a very long time, we look to Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan essentially as partners to manage the other side, to manage the Palestinians, to manage the conflicts in the region. But the cards are now held by parties with whom we have absolutely no relationship whatsoever, and which, because of the issue of the nuclear weapons in Iran, we view as a threat. Now, the fact that the U.S. is now bogged down in Iraq and that there is no sort of an easy or short-term way in which the nature of that conflict is going to change essentially means that, at least in Iran's eyes, the U.S. has very few options to be able to contain the Iranian power. In fact, the Iranians often say that they're strongest right now and the U.S. is weakest right now. This may not be the case in 5 years. It is right now, and therefore this is the time that they have to run the hardest bargain, because either they will get everything they want and they get a breakthrough now, or it will be much more difficult later on. Now, for the U.S., the problem is it doesn't want to go to a negotiation or a settlement exactly at a time when it's weakest and Iran is strongest, because it might not like the outcome of an engagement at this point in time. But there are very few options available. I think it's obviously intolerable to let the situation as is to unfold. First of all, because there is no way to contain Iran's nuclear capability under the current situation. In other words, there's no international consensus we can build around sanctions or punishing Iran, and Iran, you know, continues to go from strength to strength and continues to build. Secondly, without having any kind of a relationship with Iran, and in fact being on a collision course with Iran, we find ourselves in a situation in the Middle East where we're confronting a cascade of conflicts from Iraq to Lebanon to what might come next, over which we have very little control. And we basically have to play a catch-up, but we don't have any partners with which to work. Secondly is that there's obviously, I don't think, any good military option. I never thought there was one, and I think it's counterproductive because it will only strengthen the current government in Iran. Wars are not really favorable to democracy. Situations of national crisis don't favor civil liberties. Even James Madison said that in the Federalist Papers, that people rally to the flag, debates about democracy and political freedoms get sidelined, and the governments can assert authority and take away whatever liberties are out there even more forcefully. But even if we thought something was possible, if we looked at the lesson of Lebanon, was that Israel was able to visit horrendous sort of destruction on Lebanon, but it was not able to destroy Hezbollah, or at least in Israel's own belief, without a ground war. And it was not able to take out necessarily Hezbollah's long-range rockets with any degree of certitude. So if you looked at a country of 4 million, where the distance between the Israeli border and Beirut is far shorter than the distance between Persian Gulf and Tehran, in a country of 70 million people, you would think that, air war will not do it. Doesn't matter how punishing it becomes against Iran. It will neither dislodge the regime, nor will it actually probably completely uproot the nuclear program. What it might do is make a second Hassan Nasrallah out of Ahmadinejad, another hero for the Arab street. So none of the options, if you would, are essentially very good ones or very simple ones for the U.S. And that's partly why I think there is some interest in finding other ways to influence Iranian behavior. Namely, Iran for now has been excluded from the Middle East by the United States. It has no vested interest in the stability of the existing system. It has no vested interest in the stability of Lebanon as is, or in the stability of Iraq as is, and I believe also in the stability of Lebanon as is. We have to find a way for Iran to find interest in the stability of regions that matter to us, and then accordingly begin to influence its behavior. Why don't I stop here in the interest of time, and we can entertain questions. Thank you.
Our thanks to Vali Nasser for his comments this evening. We have a large number of questions, so let's begin. And basically straight out of some of your last comments about the military option certainly not being necessarily a good idea, but there are another number of questions about that. If Iran develops a nuclear bomb, will we be involved in World War III? And just to sort of related questions, is war between Iran and Israel inevitable, or is war between Iran and the United States inevitable?
First of all, I think Iran is not close to a bomb. In other words, it all depends on where you draw your own red lines. Iran has to master many technologies before it can actually get to a bomb. Right now, the whole debate is about enrichment. And if one way of interpreting the last IAEA report, which suggested that Iran is going slower than anticipated, is that it's having technical problems. Mastering, you know, running cascades of centrifuges is not an easy task. And even if they master that in the next year or so, then they have to master bomb making, and then they have to master delivery systems and the like. So I don't think it's there is an imminent threat. Secondly, I don't necessarily believe that in the scenario that Iran is just waiting with somebody with a finger on a button, just waiting for the bomb to get ready to launch it. Whenever Iranians actually spoke about a bomb in the 1980s and 90s, it was as a defensive mechanism when they were being attacked by chemical weapons by Saddam Hussein. We have to think, in the psychology of Iranians, no city was hit with more Scud missiles than Tehran. About 120 Scud missiles hit Tehran at the end of the war, at a time when the Iranians didn't know whether they might have chemical weapons in them or not. And a lot of them also hit the secular northern neighborhoods of Tehran. And I know people who got killed over there. So they never saw this as an offensive weapon. They rather see it as a weapon that would stabilize the country and the regime. And also they see it as a way in which it would, end the debate as to whether Iran is the big two-ton elephant in the Persian Gulf or not. I think actually, if one looked at the case of India and Pakistan, Pakistan is a country I worked in a lot, and Indians and Pakistanis' hatred of one another, particularly of their military's hatred of one another, is no less than sort of Israeli Arab or Israeli Iranian military's hatred of one another. And military weapons have actually brought about peace. There is a nuclear peace because the stakes are very high. In other words, I don't think necessarily, I think the prospect of Iran going nuclear is causing instability. I think once Iran has the weapon, everything's going to change. And I think what we're going to see at that point, which is the way the Iranians see it, that the rest of the Middle East is literally going to sort of go to the background. It's going to be about Iran and Israel. And in fact, part of the reason that Iran is ratcheting up its rhetoric against Israel, because the Iranians really don't take the other countries in the region as serious. They are seen as junior powers. In fact, they don't want the United States to compare them to the Arab regimes of the Persian Gulf or Saudi Arabia and the like. I mean, they may be completely misplaced, but that's the way they see it. They look to the north, they see Russia, they look to the east, they see China and India, and then they look to the west and they see Israel. And these are the only ones they see as their peers, militarily as well as in terms of power. So I think that's what we will see if Iran actually goes nuclear.
Just to clarify, are you saying that Iran will in fact go nuclear, get a bomb, and we just essentially have to get used to it?
I think Iran's strategy currently is to get one screwdriver short of a bomb, which is where Pakistan was for a number of years, and where Japan is, conceivably. In other words, it can go nuclear very, very rapidly. I think the Iranians are very focused on mastering the technology more than actually manufacturing it. But things can change. In other words, if the Iranian regime comes to believe that it's imminently in danger, then the argument, or that if it's hit, if actually there is a barrage of, say, cruise missiles, whether by Israel or by the United States, are launched on Iran, then all gloves are off. In other words, then they very clearly, I think, will have a very strong argument even within their own population that they need a nuclear deterrence.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. You can find more details about the Commonwealth Club at its website, commonwealthclub.org. Tonight, we're listening to author and noted Iran expert Vali Nasser. Tonight's topic is democracy in Iran. Dr. Nasser, you speak with government officials, with politicians. You're a very respected advisor on this issue. What are you telling, if you can tell us, what are you telling the administration or administration officials that you talk to, and how are they receiving what you tell them?
Well, you know, in some ways, the ground has been shifting on Iran as we've been, as things in Iraq has changed, and as the nuclear issue has changed. I think you know, one of the things that at least from our vantage point as academics, we try to do is to try to demystify the way in which Iran is seen. Unfortunately, because of the incendiary rhetoric of Ahmadinejad, you know, Iran is sort of been the entire Iranian society, country. All of the various perspectives has now been rolled up into one sort of demonic figure who, with a messianic view, who wants Armageddon tomorrow and is in control and will launch weapons the minute he gets it. Or on the other hand, the belief that there's going to be a facile and easy transition to power because there is a ready-made democracy movement in a position to take over Iran very quickly. And I think both of these views are too simplistic. There are elements of truth there, but the picture is much more complicated. So to some extent, I see my task at least is to bring some degree of you know, perspective to a lot of the information. I don't claim to know everything that the administration may know through its own intelligence gathering channels about what Iran is doing in Iraq or what it's doing with its nuclear capability, but rather to bring an understanding to, you know, how the Iranians may be calculating this and how the Iranian public, which ultimately actually is the United States' largest ally here. I mean, we keep forgetting that, you know, the not only just in Iran, but actually more broadly, I argue, in the Shia world, the only two population groups who on September 11th came out in show of sympathy with the victims in the United States were people in Tehran, and then were Shiites in Karachi, which is in Pakistan, which is a city that was dominated by Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And we always keep saying that, you know, we're standing with the people of Iran, and we see them as our ally. But we have to be very careful that we understand where the regime is different from the people and where it's not, and not use our threats as a blunt instrument that is actually ultimately going to probably turn the Iranian population away from us and push them into the bosom of the regime. I mean, already everywhere Ahmadinejad goes, one of his now favorite stump speeches everywhere is that I've offered to talk, they don't want to talk. And therefore, they are the unreasonable party, not us.
So here's another question that's been raised by a number of members of the audience. Should we talk? Should President Bush take up President Ahmadinejad's offer and talk, or perhaps even debate?
Well, I mean, I think engagement is a better word right now. I mean, talking ultimately would have to come. But I don't think either government, for domestic reasons, would like to sort of embrace public talks right away. And secondly, they're more likely would be less productive if I think they're in the open immediately. I think engagement is a better term. I mean, we need to have a diplomatic channel to all the forces in the region that are trouble for us. That is Hezbollah, Syria, and Iran. We don't have to like them. I mean, the U.S. administration was engaging the Soviet Union when President Reagan was calling him the evil empire. Or, you know, when Kissinger went to China, the Chinese war and continue to supply massive amounts of arms to North Vietnamese who are killing American soldiers. But, you know, you do diplomacy with your enemies, not with your friends. And I think it's a gaping hole in our foreign policy toolkit if we don't have any diplomatic tools with which to work. And I think, you know, both governments are sort of walking around the issue of engagement, but either side believes that the other one's not serious. And I think the Iranians believe that the U.S. is not serious about talks. It just wants to get the nuclear program shut down, and then Iran goes back in its corner as the axis of evil. And the Americans believe that the Iranians are not serious, and they want to just play for time until they get their nuclear weapons. So I think the very first purpose of engagement is really to ascertain, is Iran serious about engaging or not, without even coming to the issue of where it's going to get them. Are they really serious about wanting to end their international isolation? Do they really want to normalize their relations with the world? And once that is ascertained, then, you know, negotiations should follow from that premise, not before it.
Which leads to another question for the audience. How much bluster is Ahmadinejad, and how much action is he really bold enough to take? Is he serious, for example, about the much-talked-about, quote, Shiite arc, which presumably he would lead?
Well, this idea was actually not put forward by him. It was put forward by King Abdullah of Jordan. And in fact, the Iranians and the Shiites don't talk about Shiite-Sunni. It's the Sunnis who talk about Shiite-Sunni. Even in the Lebanon war, in the eyes of Hezbollah, this was an Arab war. It was not a Shia war. It's the Saudi government and the Jordanian government. And then radical Sunni clerics who characterized this as a Shia war and therefore wanted the Sunnis not to support it. No, I don't think Ahmadinejad would be leading this. I think it would be Ayatollah Khamenei who would be leading this. I think we overemphasize Ahmadinejad to the extent that I remember when Khatami was president, the U.S. administration did not want to talk to Khatami because he would say that Khatami is irrelevant. The president in Iran is irrelevant. And then since Ahmadinejad has become president, we're saying that the president in Iran is everything. We're forgetting that neither picture is true. I mean, Khatami was quite important in opening many doors with the West, even bringing Iran very close to a breakthrough with the U.S. And nor is it true to say that Ahmadinejad is everything. All the constitutional power is held by the head of the Iranian state, which has been the same person in that position since 1989, which is the supreme leader of Iran. Iran, in that sense, is a peculiar country in that its president is not the head of state. He's the head of the executive branch. It's kind of like the French prime minister. Ahmadinejad would like to expand his powers. And at some levels, I think the supreme leader even might view him as a threat. Or the people or the revolutionary guards who are behind Ahmadinejad as a threat. But we should not overemphasize Ahmadinejad. I think that's part of our problem. In fact, one of the benefits of engagement would be to create an issue in Iranian politics that would separate Ahmadinejad and his type from the rest.
How likely is an alliance between Iraq and Iran, especially given the growing civil warfare in Iraq? Just what is the degree of involvement in Iran by Iran in Iraq now?
Well, Iraqis and Iranians are tied together through three mechanisms. One is cultural, that the most important Shiite leaders for all Shias and Iranians included live in Najaf in Iraq. In fact, the most important of them, Ayatollah Sistani, is Iranian. By origin, and he still holds an Iranian passport and citizenship. Secondly, the Iranians have enormous amount of attachment to the Shiite shrine cities in Iraq. The estimates now are that every year, since the fall of Saddam, over 1.5 million Iranians have gone to Najaf and Karbala on pilgrimage. In fact, the economy of those cities is entirely supported by the pilgrimage trade that comes from Iran and goods and trades and everything else that goes with them. And so there is financial and cultural ties that bind the two countries. But politically, there are differences. I mean, Iraqi Shiites are Iraqi and Arab, and Iranian Shiites are Iranian. But confronted with the ferocity of Sunni resistance to Shia power in Iraq, the Shiites are pushed into the bosom of Iran. I mean, after all, Iran is the only government in the region that gave them refuge during the decade of the 1990s. And it's the only government that's giving them money and support and the like. I mean, the other Arab countries in the region have not given a dime to the Iraqi government. Rightly or wrongly, the Iraqi Shias believe it's because they are Shia, that they're not getting any money from the Gulf. For Iraqi Shias, the main concern is Sunnis and a potential for a return of Sunnis to power in Baghdad. Iran is not a problem. Iran is a problem for Saudi Arabia, for Sunnis, and for the United States. We want to preach to the Iraqis that you should really be worried about Iran. And the Iraqi Shia's answer is that you focus on the insurgency. When you're done with that, then we can talk about this issue. And I think until there is that, there is this sort of animosity that the Shiites feel in the Arab world, which they again saw it during the Hezbollah campaign, that they look at Iran as the best place to get arms, to get money, to get political support. I'm sure that once the dust is settled, once the Iraqi Shiites have sort of taken over, the relations with Iran can very easily break because the logic, the strategic logic for them will go away.
What do you make of, this is sort of going back to the possibilities of engagement, I guess, what do you make of former Iranian President Khatami's five-city U.S. tour, especially during the 9/11 anniversary period? Is this any kind of genuine effort on the part of Iran or just a publicity stunt?
I think neither. In the sense that Khatami did not have official sanction from the Iranian government to visit the United States. And by all accounts, as far as I know, he didn't even get the approval of the Supreme Leader to come on this trip. He was invited to the United Nations by Kofi Annan, who has a forum for dialogue of civilizations, one of whose members is Khatami. And once he was coming for that, and therefore the date was really set by the United Nations, not by Khatami, then he decided that he would go outside of New York on this five-city tour, and the State Department decided to give him the visa. So he's coming essentially as a private citizen, with certain moral authority of having been a reformist and sort of the positive face of the Islamic Republic. And I think he's not capable or has any ability to discuss serious issues like, what are you going to do with enrichment and when and the like. But depending on how his trip goes, he might have an impact on the public relations perception in the United States that has become extremely negative as a consequence of Ahmadinejad. But that might prove to be very short-lived because Ahmadinejad is threatened that he wants to come to the UN for another speech in September, October timeframe. So whatever gains may be made by Khatami may prove to be short-lived depending on what Ahmadinejad decides to say.
You said earlier that one of the appeals of the conservatives was that they could do governance better, they could essentially make trains run on time, but what is the situation in Iran now? There have been a number of promises about helping the poor, but there have also been reports of major discontent. Oil prices are high, but people, as I understand it, line up for gasoline. Mm-hmm. Money is leaving the country, enormous amounts of money is leaving the country. I mean, what is the situation like? I mean, is Ahmadinejad and the government fulfilling its promises to the people?
No, they're not. And you're right. First of all, Ahmadinejad's election hurt the private sector enormously. Estimates were anywhere between $40 to $50 billion left Iran, particularly for Dubai, in a flight of capital. The Iranian stock market, the real estate market, they're all sort of collapsed. Secondly, is that Iran has the oil revenue right now, has the money to spend, but spending money is not easy. I mean, it's one thing to promise every single town you visit on a tour, you're going to build a hospital. The capability of actually building it is something else. And also the Iranian parliament and the supreme leader very effectively have done to Ahmadinejad what often the U.S. Congress does to a president, which is, they basically have turned down every one of his legislations. They've ground a lot of his initiatives in sort of congressional process and the like. And one of the reasons they say that Ahmadinejad is becoming increasingly more bombastic on foreign policy issues is because he wants to divert attention from the fact that a year after his election, now a discontent has been growing and his government, other than the promises, has really nothing to show for.
How threatening, how serious is the discontent?
It is very serious. The Iranian government, the Iranian regime, takes the discontent very seriously. Democracy is not so much of a threat as unemployment and youth anger is. Youth anger in Iran is not so much about Western music and freedoms, not to say that's not there. The bigger portion of it is about jobs, is about the sort of creeping poverty among the poor. And one of the reasons why the conservatives were able to win this election was because they were able to separate the pro-democracy forces from the pro-job faction by saying, you know, priority is jobs, 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 and then comes democracy. And so therefore they now have to deliver. And if the population sort of decides that, you know, it takes its gaze off of the nuclear issue and it takes its gaze off of the confrontation with the U.S. and begins to sort of take this government to account, there could be serious trouble.
Just on the question of human rights, what is the situation there? I read that Ahmadinejad said that he wanted to basically expel all liberals and secularists from the universities. A, does he have the power to do that? B, if so, is that likely? And if you could say a little bit about human rights currently in Iran in general.
Well, generally, the human rights in Iran has deteriorated under Ahmadinejad for the reason that, you know, he has the poor and the shoeless, shirtless in the small towns on his side. And much as Chavez did in Venezuela, does not have to worry about things that the middle class wants, which is a lot of political freedoms and the like. And many more, he put a sort of a henchman at the Ministry of Culture who at the very beginning said that, you know, one of the things he wanted to do was to sort of make book censorship much more efficient. And there have been sort of clamping down on freedom of expression, on freedom of rights. A larger number of journalists, intellectuals have been put in prison. But ironically, he has loosened sort of policing of dress and the like in the sort of affluent neighborhoods of Tehran. Threats. Some of the things he says on his trips are sort of unauthorized. But once he says it, it's very difficult for the system to denounce Iran's president. Particularly the supreme leader and the like are very concerned about preserving the integrity of the system. So they're not going to come out and denounce him publicly, either on the Holocaust or on expulsion of people. So he goes out there and he says things that then, you know, they have to find a circuitous way of blocking him without appearing to be breaking ranks and denouncing the president. I don't think it will be easy for him to do it. And one of the ways that this has happened is that everybody who's being expelled from these universities is hired by now research institutes that are being set up by Ahmadinejad's rivals, particularly Ayatollah Rafsanjani, who hires them. It's sort of like a musical chairs scenario going on.
Just on the subject of Rafsanjani, there was, I think, some hope in American policy circles that Rafsanjani would win and therefore perhaps they could even do business with Rafsanjani. Was that a myth? Would Rafsanjani been any better?
Well, he did send a lot of signals that people like to hear. He told... His son told USA Today that, you know, if his father became president, then the supreme leader would become like the Queen of England. And he did tell a number of journalists that
an
he was...
interesting vision.
Very interesting vision, particularly given Britain's legacy in Iran. It was a very interesting analogy. And he told other journalists that he would solve the U.S. problem. But the problem with Rafsanjani is that he's seen to be extremely corrupt. I mean, he's an oligarch in the Russian sense of the term. He's a very entrepreneurial, you know, wheeler dealer, a maverick, you know, who's invested across the world. I mean, you know, he's building huge ski resort in Dubai, and you know, he owns large amounts of business in Canada, in Europe, and the like. But the Iranian public looks at him with a lot of cynicism. And, they always say that he's simultaneously, in every polling that media does in Iran, that he's simultaneously the most sort of respected and the most hated politician. And he doesn't go beyond a certain band. And in fact, many believe that once it became between Ahmadinejad and Rafsanjani, that Ahmadinejad would win. Because and even today, I was talking to an Iranian businessman who was very anti-Ahmadinejad, and he seems to have softened up on him recently. And I asked him about Rafsanjani. He said, well, the best thing about Ahmadinejad is that his desk doesn't have a drawer, which is, the sort of analogy for taking bribes, which is, the one thing that matters is that he's clean. And so that was ultimately Rafsanjani's problem, was corruption.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program with author and noted Iran expert, Vali Nasser. Tonight's topic is Wither Iran, democracy in Iran. A number of questions about the gentleman who your father, I guess, used to work for, and his son. Is there any sentiment? Is anybody thinking maybe the Shah wasn't so bad? And is there any sentiment for his son to come back as some sort of figurehead constitutional monarch? Or is that just more of an illusion, perhaps?
No, I think actually the Iranians look at the Pahlavi period now nostalgically as a golden era. I mean, I have also personal vignettes of being in Tehran, people sort of expressing enormous amount of sentiment towards the Pahlavis because whatever their faults were, they saw them as now fierce nationalists that genuinely tried to develop a country. And in the morass that Iran is, the vision of particularly the first Pahlavi ruler, of someone who came from nowhere, kept the country together, and essentially sowed the seeds of development is extremely attractive to them. And as a mark of how much sentiments have changed, during the presidential election, one of the conservative candidates, who was a commander of the Revolutionary Guards, in a public meeting, he said, well, don't you see how Reza Shah, we call him Reza Khan, the first Pahlavi monarch, is revered everywhere. First of all, he was admitting that he is revered everywhere. And that is because people are tired of politicians. And he said, he turned around and he said, I am the Hezbollahi Reza Khan. Basically, essentially he was trying to market himself as a Islamic Republic version of Pahlavi monarchy. Now, whether this translates into any kind of a political opportunity for the Shah's son is a whole different matter, because we've seen it also in Russia. There's a lot of sort of nostalgia for the Romanovs. Mm-hmm. There was in Bulgaria, we saw that, a lot of nostalgia for the monarchy. But that did not translate into a restoration. I think without an underground organization, no political force is going to be relevant to Iranian politics.
Was it wrong for the CIA to participate in the overthrow of Mossadegh, the former Iranian
With benefit
Prime
of
Minister,
hindsight, right? Yes. I would say, yes, historically we paid. But I think this is also because, it's not because just CIA did it, but also I think CIA insisted on making this much more than it was. In other words, CIA's contribution was not as enormous as it was. I had at one time opportunity to interview a number of senior Iranian military leaders who were participants in that coup. And they said that, it's not that the CIA controlled us. We played the Americans and the British to do what we wanted to do. And that, given with $64,000, you cannot bring down a democratically elected regime unless there is a element to it, and unless there is some ground force to it. But the CIA always presented this, for their own bureaucratic reasons in Washington, as being entirely their doing. And as a result, they contributed to sort of delegitimating the regime that they restored.
Just sort of going back to the question of Iran's economy and what the government has and hasn't done for the people. Iran is sitting on a ton of oil. Venezuela seems to be doing reasonably well with oil. Russia seems to be doing well with oil. Their economies seem to be expanding. Why isn't Iran domestically doing better economically?
Well, first of all, it has a lot of inefficiencies that has to do with any economy in which the government owns upwards of 80% of the economy. So it has the same problems that East European economies had. Secondly, this whole oil issue is the price of oil has only gone up in the past couple of years. Before that, it was not as rosy a picture. Mm-hmm. Thirdly, Iran's energy industry is in dire need of investment. Iran is a net importer of kerosene and petroleum and the like. It's the same problem Nigeria and many other countries have. In fact, one of the arguments for nuclear power in Iran is that for Iran to be able to industrialize using its own oil, it needs somewhere about $80 to $100 billion of investment only in refineries. And therefore, would you want to do that or would you want to build nuclear technology? And they look at China and, you know, India, and they're making the same kinds of arguments. That's exactly why we made a deal with India to give them nuclear technology so they can industrialize. And also at $70 a barrel, the argument is that why should you consume what you can sell at $70 a barrel? Why would you want to industrialize on the back of your cash cow? And it's exactly simplistic arguments when the Americans would say that, you know, Iran is in an oil-rich country, why does it need nuclear technology, that they would lose the public debate in Iran. Because the debate is already far more sophisticated than that simple argument, that Iran has oil, but has a problem actually using it for industrialization.
We're almost out of time. I've got two more questions, if you could take at least the first one fairly briefly, because Ahmadinejad, I mean, is such a fascinating character.
This
he
is indeed,
was to
yes.
Mike Wallace on 60 Minutes. Does he really believe the end of the world is near? And does he really believe that Israel should be or can be destroyed?
I don't think anybody in the Middle East believes Israel can be destroyed. I think this is a rhetoric mostly for domestic consumption. But they like to say it because it does carry a lot of weight in the Arab street. And what Ahmadinejad is essentially saying is that he wants to take the Middle East to days before Oslo. You know, everything that the Arabs agreed to is now off the table. That's what he's saying. So we go back to where we were in the 1960s and 1970s. Secondly, I'm sure he believes in the coming of a Messiah. Every Shia does. And I don't think he believes it any more than an average evangelical American believes in the second coming and in the rapture. And to believe that, you know, he's ready to bring Armageddon, I think is a mistaken way of looking at it. When you look at not just him, we look at the rest of the Iranian leadership, they're men of power and men of money. I don't see them ready to die. They want to grab more power and they want to exercise in ways that benefits them. But, you know, Ahmadinejad is also using this because he knows it plays on the street, because he knows that the poor, the illiterate, the provincial people have this deep attachment to the hidden imam. And, in fact, during the Khomeini years, the Iranian Messiah became far more popular for varieties of reason as part of folk religion, and he's essentially manipulating it.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there isn't time for one last question, and I have to get to the closing. Our thanks to Vali Nasser, Professor of Middle East and South Asia Politics at the Naval Postgraduate School, Adjunct Fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, and co-author of Democracy in Iran and the Shia Revival. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Andrew Ross, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.